Most Israelis, upon finishing high school, were conscripted into the military. Identified as intellectually gifted, Danny was allowed to proceed directly to university to pursue a degree in psychology. How to do this was not obvious, as the country's only college campus lay behind Arab lines, and its plans for a psychology department had been killed in an Arab ambush. And so, on a morning in the fall of 1951, the 17-year-old Danny Kahneman sat in math class, held in a Jerusalem monastery that served as one of several temporary homes for Hebrew University. Even here, Danny seemed out of place. Most of the students had just come from serving 3 years in the army, and a lot of them had seen combat. Danny was younger and dressed in a jacket and tie, which struck the other students as preposterous. For the next 3 years, Danny essentially taught himself great swaths of his chosen field, as his teachers could not. "My statistics teacher I loved," Danny recalled, "but she didn't know statistics from beans. I taught myself statistics from a book." His professors were less an assemblage of specialists than a collection of characters, most of them European refugees who happened to be willing to live in Israel. Basically, it was organized around charismatic teachers, people who had biographies, not just curriculum vitaes, recalled Avishai Margalit, who would go from Hebrew University to become a philosophy professor at Stanford, among other places. They had lived big lives. The most vivid was Yashayahu Leibowitz, whom Danny adored. Leibowitz had come to Palestine from Germany via Switzerland in the 1930s with advanced degrees in medicine, chemistry, the philosophy of science, and, it was rumored, a few other fields as well. Yet he tried and failed to get his driver's license 7 times. "You'd see him walking the streets," recalled one former Leibowitz student, Maya Bar Hillel. "His pants pulled up to his neck, he had these hunched shoulders and a Jay Leno chin. He'd be talking to himself and making these rhetorical gestures, but his mind attracted youth from all over the country." Whatever Leibowitz happened to be teaching, and there seemed no subject he could not teach, he never failed to put on a show. "The course I took from him was called biochemistry, but it was basically about life," recalled another student. A large part of the class was devoted to explaining how stupid Ben-Gurion was. He was referring to David Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister. One of Leibowitz's favorite stories was about a donkey placed equidistant from 2 bundles of hay. In the story, the donkey can't decide which bundle of hay is closer to him, and so dies of hunger. Leibowitz would then say that no donkey would do this. A donkey would just go at random to one or the other and eat. It's only when decisions are made by people that they get more complicated. And then he said, "What happens to a country when a donkey makes the decisions that people are supposed to make? You can read every day in the paper." His class was always full. What Danny recalled of Leibowitz was typically peculiar, not so much what the man had said, but the sound made by the chalk hitting the board when he wanted to make a point. It was like a gunshot. Even at that young age, and in those circumstances, it was possible to detect a drift in Danny's mind by the currents it resisted. Freud was in the air, but Danny didn't want anyone lying on his couch, and he really didn't want to lie upon anyone else's. He'd decided to attach no particular importance to his own childhood experience, or even his memories. Why should he care about other people's? By the early 1950s, some large number of the psychologists who insisted that the discipline be subject to the standards of science had given up the ambition to study the inner workings of the human mind. If you can't observe what is happening in the mind, how can you even pretend to make a study of it? What was deemed worthy of scientific attention and what could be studied scientifically was how living creatures behaved. The dominant school of thought was called behaviorism. Its king, B.F. Skinner, had gotten his start during the Second World War after the U.S. Air Force hired him to train pigeons to guide bombs. Skinner taught his pigeons to peck in the right spot on an aerial map of the target by rewarding them with food each time they did it. They did this with less enthusiasm when anti-aircraft fire was exploding around them, and so were never used in combat. Skinner's success with the pigeons was the start of a spectacularly influential career underpinned by the idea that all animal behavior was driven not by thoughts and feelings, but by external rewards and punishments. He locked rats inside what he called operant conditioning chambers. They soon became known as Skinner boxes, and taught them to pull levers and push buttons. He taught pigeons to dance and play ping pong and bang out "Take Me Out to the Ball Game" on a piano. The behaviorists presumed that whatever they discovered about rats and pigeons applied to people, on whom, for various reasons, it was simply less practical to conduct experiments. To the reader who is anxious to advance to the human subject, a word of caution is in order, Skinner wrote, in an essay called How to Teach Animals. We must embark upon a program in which we sometimes apply relevant reinforcement and sometimes withhold it. In doing this, we are quite likely in humans to generate emotional effects. Unfortunately, the science of behavior is not yet as successful in controlling emotion as it is in shaping behavior. The allure of behaviorism was that the science appeared clean. The stimuli could be observed, the responses could be recorded. It seemed objective. It didn't rely on anyone telling anyone else what he thought or felt. All the important stuff was observable and measurable. There was a joke that captured the antiseptic spirit of behaviorism that Skinner himself liked to tell. A couple makes love. Afterward, one of them turns to the other and says, "It was good for you. How was it for me?" All the leading behaviorists were WASPs, a fact that didn't go unnoticed by young people entering psychology in the 1950s. Looking back, a casual observer of the field at that time couldn't help but wonder if there shouldn't be two entirely unrelated disciplines, WASP psychology and Jewish psychology. The WASPs marched around in white lab coats, carrying clipboards and thinking up new ways to torture rats, and all the while avoided the great wet mess of human experience. The Jews embraced the mess, even the Jews who disdained Freud's methods and longed for objectivity and wished to search for the kinds of truth that might be tested according to the rules of science. Danny, for his part, longed for objectivity. The school of psychological thought that most charmed him was Gestalt psychology. Led by German Jews, its origins were in early 20th century Berlin, it sought to explore scientifically the mysteries of the human mind. The Gestalt psychologists had made careers uncovering interesting phenomena and demonstrating them with great flair. A light appeared brighter when it emerged from total darkness. The color gray looked green when it was surrounded by violet and yellow if surrounded by blue. If you said to a person, "Don't step on that banana eel," he'd be sure that you had said not eel, but peel. The Gestaltists showed that there was no obvious relationship between any external stimulus and the sensation it created in people, as the mind intervened in many curious ways. Danny was especially struck by the way that the Gestalt psychologists in their writings put their readers through an experience so that they might feel for themselves the mysterious inner workings of their own minds. If on a clear night we look up at the sky, some stars are immediately seen as belonging together and as detached from their environment. The constellation Cassiopeia is an example. The Dipper is another. For ages, people have seen the same groups as units, and at the present time, children need no instruction in order to perceive the same units. Similarly, in Figure 1, please refer to the PDF that accompanies this program, the reader has before him two groups of patches. Why not merely six patches, or two other groups, or three groups of two members each? When looking casually at this pattern, everyone beholds the two groups of three patches each. The central question posed by Gestalt psychologists was the question the behaviorists had elected to ignore. How does the brain create meaning? How does it turn the fragments collected by the senses into a coherent picture of reality? Why does that picture so often seem to be imposed by the mind upon the world around it, rather than by the world upon the mind? How does a person turn the shards of memory into a coherent life story? Why does a person's understanding of what he sees change with the context in which he sees it? Why, to speak a bit loosely, when a regime bent on the destruction of the Jews rises to power in Europe, do some Jews see it for what it is and flee, and others stay to be slaughtered? These questions, or ones like them, had led Danny into psychology. They weren't the sort to be answered by even the most gifted rat. Their answers, if they existed, could be found only in the human mind. Later in his life, Danny would say that he thought of science as a conversation. If so, psychology was a noisy dinner party during which the guests talked past one another and changed the subject with bewildering frequency. The Gestalt psychologists and the behaviorists and the psychoanalysts might all be jammed into the same building with a plaque on the front that said Department of Psychology, but they didn't waste a lot of time listening to one another. Psychology wasn't like physics or even economics. It lacked a single persuasive theory to organize itself around, or even an agreed-upon set of rules for discussion. Its leading figures could, and did, say of the work of other psychologists, basically, what you're doing and saying is total bullshit. without any discernible effect on the behavior of those psychologists. Part of the problem was the wild diversity of the people who wanted to be psychologists, a rattle bag of characters with motives that range from the urge to rationalize their own unhappiness to a conviction that they had deep insights into human nature but lacked the literary power to write a decent novel, to a need for a market for their math skills after they'd been found inadequate by the physics department, to a simple desire to help people in pain. The other issue was the grandma's attic quality of the field. Psychology was a place all sorts of unrelated and seemingly unsolvable problems simply got tossed. It is possible to find two competent and highly productive academic psychologists who, if they had lunch together, would be forced to discuss the twins' chances for the pennant or Ronald the Red Killer's showmanship talents because they would have negligible overlap in their knowledge and interests in psychology, the University of Minnesota psychologist Paul Meehl wrote in the famous 1986 essay, Psychology, Does Our Heterogeneous Subject Matter Have Any Unity? One can inquire as to why this is, whether anything can be done about it, or a question that should be asked first, does it really matter anyway? Why should a behavior geneticist studying the transmission of schizophrenia be able to converse with an expert on the electrochemical processes in the retina of the wall-eyed pike? Aptitude tests revealed Danny to be equally suited for the humanities and science, but he only wanted to do science. He also wanted to study people. Beyond that, it soon became clear he didn't know what he wanted to do. In his second year at Hebrew University, he listened to a talk by a visiting German neurosurgeon who claimed that damage to the brain caused people to lose the capacity for abstract thought. The claim turned out to be false, but Danny was so taken by it in that moment that he decided to chuck psychology to pursue a medical degree so that he'd be allowed to poke around the human brain and see what other effects he might generate. A professor eventually persuaded him that it was insane to go through the misery of acquiring a medical degree unless he actually wanted to be a doctor. But it was the start of a pattern, seizing on some idea or ambition with great enthusiasm only to abandon it in disappointment. "I've always felt ideas were a dime a dozen," he said. "If you had one that didn't work out, you should not fight too hard to save it. Just go find another." In an ordinary society, it is unlikely that anyone would ever have discovered the fantastic practical usefulness of Danny Kahneman. Israel wasn't a normal society. Graduating from Hebrew University, which somehow bestowed upon him a degree in psychology, Danny was required to serve in the Israeli army. Gentle, detached, disorganized, conflict-avoiding, and physically inept, Danny wasn't anyone's idea of a soldier. Only twice did he come close to having to fight, and both instances remained, to him, vividly memorable. The first time came when the platoon that he and several others commanded was ordered to attack an Arab village. Danny's platoon was meant to circle around the village and ambush any Arab forces. The year before, after an Israeli army unit had massacred Arab women and children, Danny and his friend Shimon Shamir had discussed what they would do if they were ordered to kill Arab civilians. They decided that they would refuse the order. Here was the closest Danny would come to being given that order. "We were not supposed to go into the village," he said. "The other officers were given their orders, and I listened, and they were never told to kill civilians, but they were never told how not to kill civilians. And I couldn't ask the question because it wasn't my mission." In the event, his own mission was aborted and his unit withdrawn before it came anywhere near to shooting at anyone, and only later did he learn why. The other platoons had walked into an ambush. The Jordanian army had been waiting for them. "Had he not withdrawn, we would have been butchered." The other time, he was sent one night to lay ambushes for the Jordanian army. He had three squads in his platoon. He led each of the first two squads to their ambush sites and left subordinates in charge of them. The third, on the Jordanian border, he led himself. To find the border, his commanding officer, a poet named Chaim Guri, told him, he should walk until he reached a sign, "Frontier, stop." In the dark, Danny missed the sign. As the sun rose, what he saw instead was an enemy soldier on a hill with his back to him. He'd invaded Jordan. "I nearly started a war." The stretch of land beneath the hill in front of them, he saw, was ideally suited for Jordanian snipers looking to pick off Israeli soldiers. Danny turned to sneak his patrol back into Israel, but then he noticed that one of his men was missing his pack. Imagining the dressing down he'd receive for leaving a pack in Jordan, he and his men crept around the fringes of the kill zone. It was incredibly dangerous. I knew how stupid it was, but we would stay until we found it, because I could hear the first question, "How could you leave that pack?" That has stayed with me, the idiocy of it. They found the pack, then left. Upon his return, his superiors admonished him, but not about the backpack. They said, "Why didn't you shoot?" The Army jolted him out of his usual self-assigned role of detached observer. His year as a platoon commander, Danny said later, removed the remaining traces of the pervasive sense of vulnerability and physical weakness and incompetence which I had had in France. But he wasn't born to shoot at people. He wasn't really suited to Army life either, but the Army forced him to be suitable. They assigned him to the psychology unit. The chief feature of the Israeli Army's psychology unit in 1954 was that it had no psychologists. Upon joining it, Danny found that his new boss, the Israeli Army's chief of psychological research, was a chemist. So Danny, a 20-year-old refugee from Europe who had spent a meaningful amount of his life in hiding, found himself the Israel Defense Forces expert on psychological matters. "He was thin, ugly, and very clever," recalls Tammy Viz, who served with Danny in the psychology unit. "I was 19 and he was 21, and I think he flirted with me and I was so dumb I didn't know it. He was not a normal guy, but people liked him." They also needed him, though how much they surely did not immediately appreciate. The new nation faced a serious problem: how to organize a madly diverse population into a fighting force. In 1948, David Ben-Gurion had declared Israel open to any Jew who wished to immigrate. Over the next 5 years, the state accepted more than 730,000 immigrants from different cultures, speaking different languages. Many of the young men entering the new Israel Defense Forces already had endured unspeakable horrors. Everywhere you turned, you found people with numbers tattooed on their arms. Mothers stumbled unexpectedly upon their own children, who they thought had been murdered by the Germans, on the streets of Israeli cities. No one was encouraged to speak about what he'd experienced in war. People who had post-traumatic stress disorder were considered weaklings, as one Israeli psychologist put it. Part of the job of being an Israeli Jew was to at least pretend to forget the unforgettable. Israel was still less a nation than a fort, and yet its army was in a state of barely controlled chaos. The soldiers were poorly trained, the units poorly coordinated. The head of the tank division didn't even speak the same language as most of his men. In the early 1950s, there was no formal war between Arabs and Jews, but the senseless metronomic violence exposed vulnerabilities in the Israeli military. The soldiers tended to cut and run at the first sign of trouble, for instance, and the officers tended to lead from behind. The infantry staged a succession of failed night raids on Arab outposts, during which Israeli troops got lost in the dark and never reached their targets. In one case, after a unit sent out to stage an attack spent the night wandering around in circles, the platoon commander had simply shot himself. When they managed to engage the enemy, the results were often disastrous. In October 1953, an Israeli unit that may or may not have been given instructions not to harm civilians had raided a Jordanian village and killed 69 people, half of them women and children. Since the First World War, the job of assessing and sorting young conscripts into armies had fallen to psychologists, mainly because some ambitious psychologists had talked the U.S. Army into giving them the job. Still, if you need to sort tens of thousands of young men quickly into an efficient fighting force, it's not immediately obvious that you also need a psychologist, and even less obvious when the only psychologist at hand is a 21-year-old graduate of a 2-year program who has more or less taught himself. Danny himself was surprised they asked him to do it and did not feel equipped for the job, and he'd already seen the difficulty of trying to figure out which person was suited to which job when his superiors had asked him to evaluate candidates for officer training school. The young men applying to become officers had been given a weirdly artificial task: to move themselves from one side of a wall to the other without touching the wall, using only a long log that was not permitted to touch either the wall or the ground. We noted who took charge, who tried to lead and was rebuffed, how cooperative each soldier was in contributing to the group effort, Danny wrote. We saw who seemed to be stubborn, submissive, arrogant, patient, hot-tempered, persistent, or a quitter. We saw competitive spite when someone whose idea had been rejected by the group sabotaged its efforts. And we saw reactions to crisis. Under the stress of the event, we felt each man's true nature was revealed. The impression we had of each candidate's character was as direct and compelling as the color of the sky. He had had no trouble identifying which men would make good officers and which would not. We were quite willing to declare, "This one will never make it, that fellow is rather mediocre," or "He will be a star." The problem came when he tested his predictions against the outcomes, how the various candidates had actually performed in officer training. His predictions were worthless. And yet, because it was the Army and he had a job to do, he kept on making them. And because he was Danny, he noted that he still felt confident about them. The situation reminded him of the famous Mueller-Liar optical illusion. See Figure 2 in the PDF. Presented with two lines of equal length, the eye is tricked into seeing one as being longer than the other. Even after you prove to people with a ruler that the lines are identical, the illusion persists. They'll insist that one line still looks longer than the other. If perception had the power to overwhelm reality in such a simple case, how much power might it have in a more complicated one? Danny's commanding officers believed that each branch of the Israel Defense Forces had its own personality. There was a fighter-pilot type, and an armored unit type, and an infantry soldier type, and so on. They wanted Danny to determine for which branch any particular recruit was best suited. Danny set out to create a personality test that would effectively sort the entire population of Israel into the correct buckets. He began by listing the handful of traits he thought most obviously correlated with a man's fitness for combat service: masculine pride, punctuality, sociability, sense of duty, capacity for independent thought. The list of traits was not derived from anything, he later said. I just thought it up. A professional would take years to do it, using pretests, trying out multiple versions, etc., but I didn't know it was difficult to do. The hard part, Danny thought, was getting an accurate measure of any of these traits from an ordinary job interview. The subtle difficulties that arise when people evaluate other people had been described back in 1915 by an American psychologist named Edward Thorndike. Thorndike asked U.S. Army officers to rate their men according to some physical trait, physique, for example, and then assess some less tangible quality, intelligence, leadership, and so forth. He discovered that the feeling created by making the first ranking bled into the second. If an officer thought a soldier physically impressive, he also found him impressive in other ways. Switch the order of assessment, and the same problem occurred. If a person was first judged to be generally great, he was then judged to be stronger than he actually was. Obviously, a halo of general merit is extended to influence the rating for the special ability, or vice versa, Thorndike concluded. He went on to say that he had become convinced that even a very capable foreman, employer, teacher, or department head is unable to view an individual as a compound of separate qualities and to assign a magnitude to each of these in independence of the others. Thus was born what is still called the halo effect. Danny knew of the halo effect, and he could see that the Israeli Army interviewers had been its victims. They had been spending 20 minutes with each new recruit, and from the encounter offering a general impression of the recruit's character. General impressions had been proven to be misleading, and so Danny wanted to avoid them. For that matter, he wanted to avoid having to rely on human judgment. Exactly why he mistrusted human judgment, he was unsure. In retrospect, he suspected he must have read a recent book by Paul Meehl, the same Meehl who wondered what, if anything, unified the field of psychology. Meehl's book, called Clinical versus Statistical Prediction, had shown that psychoanalysts who tried to predict what would become of their neurotic patients fared poorly compared to simple algorithms. Published in 1954, just a year before Danny overhauled the Israeli Army's assessment of the country's youth, it had angered psychoanalysts, who believed that their clinical judgments and predictions had great value. It also raised a more general question. If these putative experts could be misled about the value of their predictions, who would not be misled? All I know is that I must have read Meehl because of what I did, said Danny. What he did was teach the Army interviewers, young women mainly, how to put a list of questions to each recruit to minimize the halo effect. He told them to pose very specific questions, designed to determine not how a person thought of himself, but how the person had actually behaved. The questions were not just fact-seeking, but designed to disguise the facts being sought, and at the end of each section, before moving on to the next, the interviewer was to assign a rating from 1 to 5 that corresponded with choices ranging from never displays this kind of behavior to always displays this kind of behavior. So, for example, when evaluating a recruit's sociability, they'd give a 5 to a person who forms close social relationships and identifies completely with the whole group, and a 1 to a person who is completely isolated. Even Danny could see that there were all kinds of problems with his methods, but he didn't have the time to worry too much about them. For instance, he briefly agonized over how to define a 3. Was it someone who was extremely sociable on occasion, or someone who was moderately sociable all the time? Both, he basically decided. The big thing was that the judge was to keep her private opinions to herself. The question was not, what do I think of him, but what has he done? The judgment of who went where in the Israeli army was to be made by Danny's algorithm. The interviewers hated it, he recalled. I had a mutiny on my hands. I still remember one of them saying, you're turning us into robots. They had a sense that they could tell a person's character, and I was robbing them of that. And they really didn't like it. Danny then had himself driven by an assistant around the country so that he could ask army officers to assign character trait ratings to their own soldiers, which he could then compare to the soldiers' performance. Find the characteristics of the people who are good in a particular branch of the military, his thinking went, and you could use them to identify others who shared those traits and should be assigned to that branch. His memory of his trip was typically unusual, preserving a curious detail rather than the broad picture. He didn't recall much about his encounters with combat officers, but he remembered vividly what the driver had said after Danny had taken the wheel of the Jeep. Danny had never before driven. After he braked in anticipation of a bump in the road, the driver praised him. He said, "That is exactly the right gentleness." From the combat officers in the field, Danny learned that he'd been sent on a fool's errand. The military stereotypes were false. There were no meaningful differences between the personalities of successful people in the different branches. The personality that succeeded in the infantry was more or less the same as the personality that succeeded beside an artillery piece or inside a tank. The scores on Danny's personality test did predict something, however. They predicted the likelihood the recruit would succeed in any job. They gave the Israeli army a better idea than it had before of who would succeed as an officer or as a member of some elite service, fighter pilot, paratrooper, and who would not. They also turned out to predict who would end up in jail. Maybe, more surprisingly, the results were only loosely correlated with intelligence and education, which is to say, they contained information that those simple measures did not. The effect of what became known informally as the Kahneman score was to make better military use of an entire nation and, in particular, to reduce, in the selection of its military leaders, the importance of raw, measurable intelligence and increase the importance of the qualities on Danny's list. The process Danny created proved to be so successful that the Israeli military has used it right up to the present day with only minor adjustments. When women were admitted to combat units, for instance, masculine pride became pride. They tried to really change it once, said Reuven Gaul, the author of A Portrait of the Israeli Soldier. Gaul served for 5 years as chief psychologist of the Israel Defense Forces. They made it worse, so they changed it back. Upon leaving the army in 1983, Gaul went to Washington, D.C. on a National Academy of Sciences research associateship. There, one day, he had a call from a top general in the Pentagon. He says, "Would you mind coming to talk to us?" Gaul went over to the Pentagon to be interrogated by a room full of U.S. Army generals. They put their question in many different ways, but Gaul said, "It was always the same question. Please explain to me how it is possible you guys use the same rifles we use, drive the same tanks we drive, fly the same airplanes we fly, and you are doing so well winning all of the battles, and we are not. I know it's not the weapons, it must be the psychology. How do you pick the soldiers for combat?" For the next 5 hours, they picked my brain about one thing, our selection process. Later, when he was a university professor, Danny would tell students, "When someone says something, don't ask yourself if it is true. Ask what it might be true of." That was his intellectual instinct, his natural first step to the mental hoop, to take whatever someone had just said to him and try not to tear it down, but to make sense of it. The question the Israeli military had asked him, which personalities are best suited to which military roles? It turned out to make no sense. And so Danny had gone and answered a different, more fruitful question. How do we prevent the intuition of interviewers from screwing up their assessment of Army recruits? He'd been asked to divine the character of the nation's youth. Instead, he'd found out something about people who try to divine other people's character. Remove their gut feelings, and their judgments improved. He'd been handed a narrow problem and discovered a broad truth. The difference between Danny and the next 999,999 psychologists is his ability to find the phenomenon and then explain it in a way that applies to other situations, said Dale Griffin, a psychologist of the University of British Columbia. It looks like luck, but he keeps doing it. A different, more ordinary person would have left the experience brimming with confidence. In a stroke, 21-year-old Danny Kahneman had exerted more influence upon the Israeli army, the institution on which the society depended for its survival, than any psychologist had ever done or ever would do. The obvious next step for him was to go off and get his PhD and become Israel's leading expert in personality assessment and selection processes. Harvard was home to some of the leading figures in the field, but Danny decided, without anyone's help, that he wasn't bright enough to go to Harvard and didn't bother to apply. Instead, he went to Berkeley. When he returned to Hebrew University as a young assistant professor in 1961, after 4 years away, he was freshly inspired by personality studies being done by the psychologist Walter Mischel. In the late 1960s, Mischel created these wonderfully simple tests on children that wound up revealing a lot about them. In what became known as the marshmallow experiment, Mischel put 3-, 4-, and 5-year-old kids in a room alone with their favorite treat, a pretzel stick, a marshmallow, and told them that if they could last a few minutes without eating the treat, they'd receive a second treat. A small child's ability to wait turned out to be correlated with his IQ and his family circumstances and some other things as well. Tracking the kids through life, Mischel later found that the better a 5-year-old resisted the temptation, the higher his future SAT scores and his sense of self-worth, and the lower his body fat and the likelihood he'd suffer from some addiction. Gripped by a new enthusiasm, Danny designed a bunch of marshmallow test-like experiments. He even coined a phrase for what he was doing, the psychology of single questions. He arranged for Israeli kids on camping trips, this was just one example, to be offered a choice between sleeping in a single tent, a 2-person tent, or an 8-person tent. Perhaps their answers, Danny thought, would say something about their tendency to affiliate with a group. The idea yielded either no findings or findings he couldn't replicate in a subsequent experiment, and so he gave up. I wanted to be a scientist, he said, and I thought I can't be a scientist unless I can replicate myself. I couldn't replicate myself. Doubting himself once again, he abandoned the study of personality, deciding he had no talent for it.